The headlines this hour. Russia says the U.S. decision to deploy more troops near its borders will fuel tensions in Europe after Washington decides to send 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. The Bank of England raises interest rates for the second time in 3 months as it comes under pressure to curb the country's surging inflation. And two major Palestinian resistance groups, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad movement, blast the Bahraini regime for hosting the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, slamming its normalization with Israel.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us.
Russia urges the United States to stop escalating tensions over Ukraine after Washington announced a decision to deploy thousands of extra troops to Eastern Europe. The Kremlin spokesman denounced the planned troop deployment, noting that Moscow's concerns over NATO's eastward expansion are absolutely justified. Dmitry Peskov said Moscow has been constantly calling on Washington to stop aggravating tensions in Europe, but to no avail. On Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned against U.S. attempts to drag his country into a war, saying that Washington is not concerned about the security of Ukraine. The West has been accusing Russia of planning to invade Ukraine, a claim that Moscow has repeatedly rejected. We have talked to political analyst William Jones to get his thoughts on recent escalation of tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. He believes that the U.S. goal is to use the situation in Ukraine as a pretext to contain Russia.
There is no indication that Russia plans to invade Ukraine. The moves that they are taking on their border is on the border of a country which is in the state of a veritable civil war. And the reason they put the troops on the border is really to send a signal about not only about Ukraine, but also about the dangerous direction in which all of the agreements that have been made between Russia and the West since the fall of the Soviet Union are being violated effectively by the United States in this expansion of NATO right up to the border of Russia. Well, obviously, the United States, the West generally, the United States is more interested in creating their own control over all of the parts of Europe that are not Russia. So that the goal here, although it's talked about in terms of the defense of Ukraine and victimization of Ukraine, is really an attempt to create a cordon around Russia, which they consider not only a rival and a competitor, but also a potential enemy. And by doing so, they hope that they can keep Russia in a boxed in effectively, so that no moves are made one way or the other, which would endanger the hegemony of the so-called U.S. rules of the road.
The Bank of England increases its forecast for peak inflation yet again, admitting price rises are likely to reach over 7% in April. The central bank says that inflation would likely hit 6% this month before peaking at 7.25%. Forecast in December estimated a peak of 6% by spring. The bank's Monetary Policy Committee says the raised prediction is mainly reflects global energy and goods prices. Higher global gas prices have forced the government to announce a big hike in the energy price cap, which will come into force in April. Meanwhile, the Bank of England has raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months as it tries to curb a rapid rise in the cost of living. Well, the cost of living in the 19-country Eurozone hits an all-time high as inflation rises to more than 5%. EU lawmakers demand emergency measures to prevent even more citizens from falling into poverty. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation Eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. We need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.
Some EU lawmakers say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and the Islamic Jihad movement condemned Bahrain's reception of the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs in his unannounced visit to the Arab country. Hamas denounced the landing of an Israeli military aircraft carrying Benny Gantz and a number of Israeli commanders in Manama. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement stressed its opposition to all forms of normalization of relations with Israel. Other Palestinian resistance groups have also denounced the trip, saying that it shows the moral degradation of Bahraini officials. Bahrain normalized its relations with Israel 2 years ago under a U.S. brokered deal. Palestinians have repeatedly stamped normalization deals between sub-Arab states and the regime as a stab in the back, saying such relations only serve the Zionist interests in the region. Sud Nims, professor of political science, joins us from Birzeit University. Welcome. Let's look at the whole notion of how this normalization has come about and what we're seeing at this point in this particular visit, an unannounced visit, as it was stated. Do you get the sense that Israel is using these Persian Gulf Arab countries like Bahrain, like the UAE, to serve its own purposes security-wise?
In fact, yes, indeed. The Israelis are the most using this relationship with Arab countries that normalize relation with Israel for their own benefits, not only on the economic side, but also on other sides such as the security as well. You know that for security reasons, the Israelis wanted this relationship, especially in the Gulf States, so they can have access for their airplanes to go wherever they would like to go, to cross the Arabian Peninsula, to get to even to the borders of Iran in such case, and especially with the Emirates and with Bahrain and other countries, they are trying, you know, to get benefit out of this kind of relationship. In addition to that, they are covering their atrocities against the Palestinian people by these kind of relationships, hence that, you know, these countries are normalizing with Israel, and Israel is a good country, and they forget about what they are doing to the Palestinians. So indeed, this kind of relationship and normalization of some of the Arab countries, it is totally in the interest of Israel and none any kind of interest for the Arab countries at all.
Well, and to go along those lines, Israel also seems to want to make inroads through these Persian Gulf countries, or Arab countries, into other countries, for example, in Africa, or anywhere else that perhaps they're not that welcome. So they're using these countries in that respect. And maybe these countries, the Arab countries, are given economic, perhaps, promises by Israel. at the same time, again, it doesn't seem like it's a fair shake that these Arab countries are getting.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because by the end of the day, what could they get out of Israel economically? The Gulf states are all, oil states, and they have a lot of money, and especially the Emirates, they have lots of developments, and they don't need Israel. Israel, by the end of the day, is not that very sophisticated in terms of technology and all other means that might be needed by the Arab countries, if to compare by the European or Americans. They can get the same services from other countries, not necessarily from Israel. So by the end of the day, there isn't much to earn from Israel by these Arab countries. To the contrary, the Israelis are benefiting out of this relationship and getting closer to the region, and to be able to reach anywhere in the region. As you mentioned, in the terms of Africa and the relationship with Africa, and especially now on Monday, there will be this the conference for the African countries, and to review the membership of Israel as an observer in the African Union. We think that the Israelis are trying to get to what they can in the region, to build relationship, to feel that they are wanted and they are agreed upon by all these countries, and that the peace is, from their point of view, is like this kind of peace, as they put it in Abraham deal.
Thank you very much for that, Saad Nim, professor of political science at Birzeit University. Thank you. Moving on, U.S. Special Forces have carried out an overnight operation in Syria's Idlib province, leaving over a dozen civilians dead. Witness reports indicate at least 13 people, including 6 children, lost their lives in the assault. The Pentagon, however, is describing the operation as a successful counterterrorism mission, saying that there were no U.S. casualties. President Joe Biden says Daesh leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi was killed in the raid. Biden's claim contradicts the senior U.S. official's account that says Qureshi blew up himself and his family members at the beginning of the operation. Last December, the U.S. carried out similar operations in Idlib, causing civilian casualties. Washington said it was investigating the case, but so far, there have been no statements about these civilian casualties. Lebanon's Hezbollah parliamentary bloc has reiterated its full commitment to the National Accord document. The charter is based on the 1989 Taif Agreement that ended the civil war in Lebanon. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says that Hezbollah has made the remarks in response to the Lebanese Forces Party, which has started a political, social, and religious campaign against the bloc. She says the group led by Samir Jaja is acting in violation of the national charter.
Generally speaking, the national charter does keep the sense of national security and peace that was present after the civil war ended in 1991. And this is what they're trying to say. They said that they are trying to preserve that stance despite the fact that you do have one of the political groups, which is the Lebanese Forces Party, led by Samir Jaja, that has been launching some sort of a campaign. And lately, it was not only a political campaign, we also had some violence, which Hezbollah has accused the Lebanese Forces Party of, that they have armed men who shot at unarmed protesters when they were protesting several months ago against the judge of the Beirut port blast. In addition to that, you also now, recently, we have statements of their information, the head of the information office of the Lebanese forces, launching a religious attack against Hezbollah and the Shiites in general, saying that their ideology that goes back 1,400 years is a ridiculous ideology, and so on and so forth. And that led to a lot of bickering on the political political screen, and that Hezbollah is stressing, the supporters and all Shiites, of course, have said that this goes against the national charter, it goes against the right of the person to of course practice their religion and not to be ridiculed, and the fact that there has to be tolerance among the religions. Mm-hmm. So this is why Hezbollah is stressing that point, and this is why it's very important, and up until now they are being very diplomatic, of course, when it comes to responding to those campaign, which is, like I said, now political, religious, and social.
Japan says Tehran and Tokyo have great potential to further expand their economic cooperation once the existing obstacles are removed. Japanese Foreign Minister Yoshimasa Hayashi made the remark in a phone call with his Iranian counterpart. He expressed support for the talks in Vienna between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal, aimed at restoring the accord known as the JCPOA. He called on all the parties to take serious measures in fulfilling their obligations to reach an agreement. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, for his part, stressed his country's readiness to reach a good, lasting, and reliable agreement in Vienna. The eighth round of the talks focused on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and Tehran's commitments under the JCPOA. Negotiations were put on hold last month for the negotiators to return to their capitals for consultations. The war in Yemen, now in its seventh year, has entered a new phase. The Yemeni army has targeted positions inside the UAE on more than one occasion to drive home the message that the country should stop being a party in this devastating, indiscriminate war. But the U.S. has offered to prop up support for the UAE by deploying an aircraft carrier and fighter jets, a sign of its growing engagement in the conflict.
The U.S. appears to be getting more involved in the war on Yemen. The Pentagon is dispatching a guided missile destroyer and fifth-generation fighter jets to the region amid increasing retaliatory air raids by Yemeni armed forces on vital facilities in the United Arab Emirates. The Pentagon is reportedly reviewing a range of actions to support the UAE. These include providing early warning intelligence, collaborating on air defense, and sending the U.S. Navy guided missile destroyer, the USS Cole, to partner with the UAE Navy. The United States military has also launched interceptor missiles in response to Yemen's retaliatory strikes that targeted the United Arab Emirates. The interventions are seen as a widening U.S. involvement in the war on Yemen. The war was launched by a Saudi-led coalition, which also includes the UAE. The U.S. had officially suspended its offensive in support of Saudi-backed militants. The UAE hosts some 2,000 U.S. soldiers and serves as a crucial base of operations for the deployment of armed drones and F-35 stealth fighters.
The U.S. wants to keep expanding its war machine, and unfortunately the people of Yemen have been devastated by U.S. Western imperialism through Saudi Arabia as its proxy by constant bombings. Yemen is one of the most impoverished nations, not because of the Yemeni people, but because of the brutal attacks launched on Yemen. Hundreds of thousands of people have died.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a topic that we have been speaking about for a couple of sessions, and that is the question on violence and Islam. People often ask, is Islam a violent religion, or is it not a violent religion? So we want to address this question today. I think the underlying line of reasoning behind this question is an outlook and a idea about God that goes back to how certain followers of certain religions view God. God is often portrayed in, you know, religions as being a very kind and merciful being who will forgive everything at the stroke of, you know, whatever, you know. And therefore, the religion that he says should also be similar. It should be very forgiving. It should be very kind. The followers of these religions should be very merciful, should be very kind, and so on and so forth. So I think that we can answer this question by saying that this assumption is based upon an incorrect notion of God. Right? So it's true that God Almighty is a being that has the ability to forgive, and that he has he's a kind and merciful entity. Nevertheless, according to Islamic religion and according to Islamic theology, he's also a being which has other sifat and attributes as well. He's the Muntaqim, right? He's the Jabbar, right? He's the all-powerful, he's the Avenger. These are also sifat and attributes of God, which we consider as perfections of God, right? As perfections and qualities which convey perfections. And if God did not possess these, he wouldn't be a perfect and a complete entity, right? So it's not necessarily true to say that because God is an all-merciful and he's a all-forgiving and all-kind being, that the religion that he sends should necessarily be in this way. an important idea that we should think about here in order to understand the nature of what transpires in the hereafter in the form of the punishments that human beings will undergo is this, is that the actions that we perform in this world and the punishments that occur in the hereafter form a cause and effect relationship. This is something that people don't take into consideration. For example, we usually think of the punishments that occur in the hereafter as similar to the punishments that occur, that people have formulated as penal punishments in this world. In other words, they're simply conventional. There's no cause-effect relationship between them. However, the truth of the matter is that the actions that we perform in this world and the punishments that are meted out in the hereafter for those actions form a cause-effect relationship, right? So these punishments that we undergo are not the effects of God's wrath. They're not similar to like the punishment that a parent would inflict upon his child when he becomes angry upon him. It would be more similar to the negative reaction that occurs in the body of a person when he eats something harmful for him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at Islam and violence. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Epic. Glory. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Kornbluh. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. and starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labour Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. People don't trust that our society is working for most people.
Got to pay my bills, got to pay my rent. I'm hungry outside, but my money's all spent.
Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active.
New York now! New York now!
Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, you know, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And so. Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era. But that was just a temporary blip post-war in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so, but I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned, and sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard, and he said, you know, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is, he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realize the pool, the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
No, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes. But also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well-versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view. But what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, which is quite a shocking thing to say. But when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. that's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
There's strong arguments indeed made in this film, and of course aided by great animation sequences,
yeah.
and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
What we're beginning to see,
yep.
is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these,
yeah.
fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You, yeah. used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
book
we just make, can you...
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again?
Mine.
Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on, if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him actually on this issue. And do you think Reich has all that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he's Democrat, so he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming, or what they're trying to do, is the same thing, just overthrow the system. And,
but
and that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was early elections when they were,
yeah.
filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly. And we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so... corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So you know, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests. And the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue, or Democrat to Republican, or vice versa, is going to change anything. We saw it with We saw it with Obama, we've seen it with Trump, you know, and, you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor, and I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just kind of eating itself, and it's very much it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very telling.
It's not surprising, but it kind of helps. It helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how or, you know, how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps. It helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of a film does. It might get people to stand up and say, "Wait a minute." Something has
to happen. It's an empowering documentary. Yeah.
And there's a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing. And there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history.
Mm-hmm. So. I would like to touch on that actually a little bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas, and then my phone bill. I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories, the McDonald's worker, and also we saw Farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living, and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Reich raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. and it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money, it's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that
never
just exacerbates
debt.
It. So this process, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, and the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of
understanding, at least it's a good starting point.
I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
It's just, you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah, you do see him getting frustrated. And you saw him, like, in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And, of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. So for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment. What is the alternative to receiving new chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities, and they're not allowed to have obscene profits because they're utilities. They're something everybody has to have. And
of course, essential.
And that's kind of it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits and put people, you know, make people poor, basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was, one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up.
That is very worrying indeed. And just as we end in near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think? I'm sorry, Rich. Do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So,
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on. And maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there. But I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.